We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Show, episode 147.
On today's show, we talk about archaeological hoaxes, forgeries, and practical jokes.
Let's dig a little deeper. Welcome to the show, everybody. How's it going?
Pretty good.
All right.
Today, I would like to execute some practical jokes on you.
What?
I guess if I say I'm going to practical joke you, that like ruins the whole practical joke, doesn't it?
Yeah, a little bit.
Now, today we are talking about hoaxes in archaeology, in science, and history. There's just a whole like slew of different hoaxes and practical jokes in history that people have executed over the years. And we just wanted to deep dive a couple of the ones that we found more interesting as we were doing this research.
Yeah, and some of the motivations behind these things are different. Sometimes people just want fame, you know, and fame could be academic fame. There's people that have maybe found something and thought, you know, or maybe published too early or told people too early and then kind of had to stick to their guns. Otherwise, their career is literally ruined.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's happened before.
Yeah.
Or people just try to create their own narrative. I think that's the design behind most hoaxes is people are like, you know what? I see this thing going on over here and I don't like the history that they're finding. So I'm pretty sure I'm right and we'll find evidence soon. But either way, I'm just going to put this thing over here so we can create a new history.
I'm not even sure that a lot of the people behind hoaxes mean for it to be what it is, you know.
Maybe.
Like they're not making a decision like I am going to fake this evidence right now so that I can prove my point. I don't think that necessarily happens. I think that people just get wrapped up in the idea of the thing that they think is true, and you just can't say otherwise to them. You can't. They just will not hear any criticism against what they think is true or what they've found or whatever.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's a tough thing. And as a scientist, you really have to keep an open mind, even about your own evidence and your own things that you've discovered, as all of these hoaxes and practical jokes in some cases will show.
Yeah. This first one we're going to talk about is something that happened back in the 30s. I'll let Rachel describe it, but it's kind of interesting with this one because we were definitely able to, you know, prove this was a hoax later on with more evidence around when horses were around in the North American continent. So take it away.
Yeah. So full disclosure, I totally found this story on one of the archaeology Facebook groups. I think it was the archaeology field text group or something like that, where people were talking about it. And I don't always get totally pulled into those conversations on Facebook. I usually just do like a quick skim, you know, but this one, the conversation totally sucked me in because there was still a debate going on about horses. Like an actual debate broke out between a couple people in that chat. You guys should go find it if you haven't seen it already, where there was one very lovely human who was very patiently debunking the things that were being said by the person who was perpetuating this myth that horses never went extinct in North America. So it was a very interesting conversation to follow, and it just blew my mind that people still think this.
Yeah, before we go on, the Archaeo Field Text group on Facebook is a private group, so it requires membership.
And oh, true.
To be honest, we only let in people. I'm one of the moderators. We only let in people who are actually working in the archaeology space. But you can find a lot of stuff online about horses and debates around horses. It seems to be a pretty hot topic.
It is,
for people about like when horses were here, because people don't seem to understand that there was a version of horses here a while back.
Yeah,
and then they went extinct. And then horses came back with Europeans.
With Europeans, yeah. That's the really short story of the history of horses in America. And that's really all you need to know.
Yeah.
And I found an amazing article. Okay, I did not find this article. Some lovely human on Facebook found this amazing article. They linked to it in that conversation I was talking about. And we will link to it in the show notes. Because if you want to know the full story behind why people believe that horses never went extinct here, then you can go read this article. It really breaks it down. It's really great. And I highly recommend reading that. We'll give you some of the high notes from that article. Okay, so let's start with the hoax, though, the hoax that led us down this path. This is the Spencer Lake horse skull. Now, this is a horse skull that was found at the bottom of a Native American mound. And this mound dates to 1100 to 1400-ish CE. And because they found that horse skull at the bottom of the mound, that places horses squarely in the time frame between when they went extinct and then were brought back to the Americas by Europeans.
You know why everything moved so slowly during that time in North America? There was no horsepower.
Oh, God, you're the worst. Oh, yep, that is true. Everything moved super slowly. So, no, in 1936, this mound was excavated by W.C. McKern, who is the curator of Milwaukee Public Museum. And he, of course, was floored when he found this skull in the mound because he, like all others, believed that the American version of horses had gone extinct about 10,000 years ago, I believe, was the extinction time frame for horses.
I'm not certain when that is, so we'll be cautious on our dates.
We will be. And the article that I mentioned where somebody totally breaks down the horse thing, it does have the dates in it. I'm just not looking at it right now, but it does have those dates in it. So you can check that out there.
Hey, go check out some, maybe we'll link to it if we remember, but go check out the Life in Ruins podcast. They do have some, there was an episode, if you're listening to this in 2021, there was an episode a few months ago where they have on a couple of people that they know that are Paleo-Indian and those time periods experts, and they talked pretty extensively about horses. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a pretty good episode.
Yeah. Of course, this skull was way too good to be true, right?
Sure.
Or way too fake to be true? I don't know. But two students almost immediately took credit for planting it in the mound. Mm-hmm. I guess as like a joke on the, not professor, but the museum curator who was excavating it, that the motivations for why they planted it are unclear. Mm-hmm. But they definitely immediately came out publicly like, whoa, 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 hold on. We put this here as a joke. I wouldn't even be surprised if they didn't even realize that by choosing to put a horse skull there, they were like jumping into this like debate about horses and their extinction in this country or in this continent.
I think they did know what they were doing because they took the perfect skull to put there.
That is true. Yeah.
Right.
It sets off this huge controversy, right?
Yeah.
But McKern, the excavator, he insisted that the skull was in situ and they could not have placed it there. The soil was undisturbed, according to him, around the skull. Therefore, they are lying. The students are lying. And the skull was actually in place where it naturally was.
For me, that's one point in McKern's favor, because I'm just like, how are those guys excavating this that they didn't notice disturbed soil? I mean, we can dig. We can notice evidence of rodent activity or evidence of even a post hole that was dug 1,000 years ago.
We can.
Because we can tell about that. We can tell the changes in the soil. Now, it might have the same compactness now 1,000 years later. Mm-hmm. But if you dug something last week, I mean, you'd have to be really good about not only like packing that back down, but kind of disturbing. And how did they get all the way down in the mound? And it's just there's a lot of holes there for not only where this was found, but how they were doing the excavation in a way that they didn't notice that this was buried probably within the last few weeks.
Yeah, that is interesting. It makes me wonder a couple things. One, McKern, he was the curator of the public museum, but it doesn't say what his other credentials were. So It does make me question what his excavation experience was. And when you're dealing with different types of soils, some things can be completely disturbed, but not necessarily look disturbed. Yeah. So that could be a factor here. And also, like, if he just doesn't have a lot of experience looking for disturbance, he might have just completely missed it, you know?
Well, and it was the 30s. They could have just been chunking that stuff out with big old shovel loads.
Oh, they totally could
going
have.
Going for the good stuff.
Yeah, like, if the students had, like, very carefully excavated just a hole just big enough for the skull, then maybe that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I don't want to, like, assign reasons to people when we don't really know like what he was thinking, but it does kind of seem like he really enjoyed the glory of discovering that horses hadn't gone extinct like everybody previously said.
Yeah.
And he might have been ignoring the confession from the students a little bit just to be able to continue with the story that he discovered, you know? And I get that. And it might not have even been a conscious decision to do that, you know? So now, of course, we have modern scientific dating now. And in 2001, this controversy was completely laid to rest with radiocarbon dating that proved that the skull was modern. So,
yeah. And we only needed the proof because by that time, we had pretty solid evidence that horses couldn't possibly have existed during that time frame.
Yeah.
You know, the only way a horse could have existed during that time frame is if somebody from the European continent had brought one over hundreds of years before we thought they did. And not that that wouldn't have been impossible. We covered Vikings coming to this country, but I'm not even sure Vikings came over in boats that were the size that could handle transporting a horse across the Atlantic.
Oh, right.
You know what I mean? Because you have to have all the food. You got to deal with it. It's not like a 2-day journey.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty nasty. They came over in some pretty stout boats, but I'm not 100% certain that they were transporting horses at that time. But that would be a super interesting theory, because if they were here 1,000 years ago and they brought horses with them, what are the chances they brought the horses back? But also, what are the chances the horses would just thrive on their own and breed and do stuff? I mean, horses.
They do, though. I mean,
they do. But horses, I mean, you would have to have brought male and female horses. Yeah. I don't know if they would have thought about that.
True.
You would have to have made sure that those horses are of breeding age and, you know, all kinds of things, and that they're even, you know, interested in each other. They're not just going to go breed with each other. Maybe the one goes one way and one goes the other way. So who knows? But
well, the debate over horses is super interesting, and honestly, it shouldn't even be a debate, but like even as recent as like 2017, there was an article or a dissertation put out by an actual like professor, an actual academic, saying that, and this is what she said, and I love this quote. She said that she begins her dissertation with a clear chip on her shoulder for so-called mainstream academia and Western science. Western science, this article that we're linking to, I love it so much because he's like, there is no Western science. There just is science.
Yeah.
Science is science is science. There's no Western version of it.
That's crazy.
It should be just you have a hypothesis and you test it, right? So starting by using the words Western science, just you know that anything she's going to write is coming from a place of bias, right? Yeah. And we're not going to give credence to any of the theories, but basically she's looking at skeletal remains. She's looking at geoglyphs. She's looking at rock art, even some physical evidence. And her conclusion by looking at all these things is that horses never went extinct in the Americas. Mm-hmm. And it's just simply not true. That the rock art that they're looking at, it's not necessarily horses. It's some kind of four-legged animal, but you don't know that it's a horse. You can't make that assumption. Sure. And there's all kinds of other areas where you're making assumptions and saying that things are something when you don't actually know what they are.
Right.
So just want to lay that to rest. Go read this article. It's super in-depth about why everything that this dissertation says about horses is incorrect. And the main takeaway is that horses did go extinct somewhere around 10,000 years ago. And there could be an outlier, like maybe like a handful of horses made it through, but they certainly weren't here. There weren't enough of them here that we would even find it in the archaeological record, probably. So that is the conclusion to that story.
Well, while we know that the Native Americans at that time that built that mound didn't have any horsepower, I'll tell you who did. Their ancestors from 500,000 years ago who were building internal combustion engines. Let's talk about the Koso artifact next. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high-quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Z-E-N-C-A-S-T-R. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 147. And as promised, we're going to talk about the Koso artifact, as it's come to be known.
Mm-hmm.
A little backstory on this. Well, first off, Koso is also a name you may have heard if you've listened to other podcasts. It's the Koso range of mountains and the Koso petroglyphs, rock art style, a lot of Koso things, Koso sheep.
It's like Southern California, right?
Sort of Central California.
Oh, okay.
Central Southern California. If you're traveling down Interstate 395, which comes out of Nevada and goes all the way down the eastern side of California into the Mojave Desert.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about that on lots of shows because we've done a lot of work down in Ridgecrest, California, which is a little ways off 395.
Mm-hmm.
And the Koso range is just outside of Ridgecrest to the north.
Okay.
And honestly, the fact that they call this the Koso artifact is a little bit weird to me because it was found a few miles northeast of Olancha, California, which is also on 395. And that's right about at the southern edge of Owens Lake as I was looking at a map.
Oh, okay.
And Owens Lake is a pretty famous area archaeologically, but also for like Los Angeles, because I'm pretty sure most of their water comes from there.
it's a reservoir or?
No, I don't think so. It might be dammed off to hold a little more water, but there was a pretty controversial aqueduct, I think, or something put in to drain water from there all the way down to California. In fact, you drive right parallel to that aqueduct, the California,
that's right,
it's called the California Aqueduct or something like that, as you're driving down once you get to Owens Lake and beyond.
Yep.
But anyway, Owens Lake is, it's massive. I mean, absolutely massive. And probably doesn't have a whole lot of water in it right now. So
I don't think there's a lot of water anywhere in California right now.
Yeah, not too many places. Yeah. So anyway, on February 13th, 1961, Wallace Lane, Virginia Maxey, and Mike Mixell, which, come on.
That's anyway, a choice.
Yeah.
Parents.
They were looking for minerals to sell in their shop in Olancha. And Olancha, man, if anybody's ever been through there, like you don't, I think you might slow down to 55 to go through Olancha.
Tiny little town.
But not much, right? Like there's a gas station as far as I know. I think there's still like a beef jerky place. It's in my brain. Like I can see it.
Is that the town that has the movie museum in it?
No, that's Lone Pine.
Oh, it's Lone Pine. Okay. But it's all like kind of in the same area around there,
Lone
right?
Lone Pine is actually the next town to the north of Owens Lake.
Okay.
So Olancha is kind of on the south end and Lone Pine's on the north end.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Because the Alabama Hills are in that area, too, which is where many movies, Hollywood movies, are filmed when they need an alien landscape. Right?
If you've ever seen Captain Kirk fight somebody in what looks like a desert landscape, it was definitely in the Alabama Hills.
Right.
So that's Olancha. They had this mineral shop, this rock shop that a lot of people around there have stuff like this that they sell. And they were just looking for stuff. They find geodes. They find geodes, they slice them open, and they sell them. They might prep them a little bit. But they were out there. They found just a bunch of things and bring it back. And Mixell, was out, you know, just cutting them open like they do to see what was inside. And he nearly ruined one of his diamond-tipped saw blades. And that's a pretty common type of saw blade for this kind of thing. But he nearly ruined it. And when he opened up this geode and take a look at some of the articles we have, I think every single one of them has a picture of it, but when he opened up this geode, or what he thought was a geode, he saw what looked like he had just cross-sectioned porcelain, what looked like porcelain. We couldn't really tell at the time, but it looked like a porcelain like cylinder with a very small internal 2 millimeter diameter shaft on the inside with a shiny magnetic material inside of it, so that was bisected as well. And then on the outside of the porcelain was a ring of metal, but it was more hexagonal. It was like a hexagonal ring of metal. In the picture, it looks circular, but when you get up close and personal to it, it's definitely hexagonal.
Okay. Yeah. Looking at the cross section, it actually kind of reminds me of when you see like a cross section of the earth, right? Yeah. You've got like the crust on the outside, then you've got the mantle, and then you've got the core, right? It kind of looks like that. Not quite the same proportions, but that's sort of like what you're seeing in the cross section view of it.
Yeah. Interesting thing about the outside of this supposed geode, it was encrusted with, it was hard, first off. Mm-hmm. It was encrusted with fossil shells. Mm-hmm. And two non-magnetic metal objects that appeared to be a nail and a washer.
Hmm.
So just trash.
Yeah.
That it hooked itself
desert
to the side
trash.
Of this thing.
Yeah. If you've ever walked around in the desert, there's trash on the ground.
Trash everywhere.
From the last 100 years.
And you know, I don't know where these guys were walking around in, but there's roads all over Nevada. I heard a statistic one time that I've never seen validity of, but totally believe it, having driven all over Nevada. There are more unnamed like gravel roads in Nevada than paved roads in most of the western United States.
Oh, for sure. Totally believe that.
Yeah.
And this is California, but it's like an extension of that part of Nevada.
Yeah, California.
But it's like an extension of that like desert sagebrush Nevada. Yeah.
It's all very similar. So I was thinking Nevada because it's real close to Nevada, but you're right. It's just, it's crazy. The whole area is the same. So my point with that is a lot of these roads have been around there for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And people have taken very inappropriate vehicles out there for the last 100 plus years and they broke down.
Yeah.
And a lot of times back in the day, there was no AAA. There was no cell phones. There wasn't anything like that. So if you're driving, you know, a Model T, I mean, it's probably a little old, but if you're driving like a 1930s car, 20s car out in these roads, you probably have parts with you.
Yeah.
If you don't, you're an idiot.
Yeah. You have to be able to fix things.
Yeah. You got to be able to fix stuff. Mm-hmm. It's like people that drive that have sailboats or even us in the RV. We've got spare parts in the RV.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, we can get to a place. The RV is a little less like that. But like boats,
you got to have stuff with you. Oh. Yeah.
Sailboat owners that go across that go, you know, way far away from land. They got all kinds of stuff on board. Yep. They could probably build another sailboat. So anyway, a geologist told them that took an informal look at this and really, from the sounds of it, didn't really examine it. Just was maybe shown pictures or had it described, but in general told them that geodes often take about 500,000 years to form. So they said, okay, great. We've got a 500,000-year-old geode with a weird ceramic thing inside of it. Now, everybody caught on to this fact.
Yeah.
Everybody. Everybody was looking at this, and mostly creationists. Mm-hmm. And a guy named Ron Calais, who is a creationist geologist, which is a phrase I never thought I'd say.
Did not know that was a thing.
Not even sure
I thought
what's
they
happening.
Were mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
But okay.
Well, he x-rayed this sometime later. It was still when it was in the artifact's been lost to history. The guys who found it, one of them's dead now, and the thing is just nowhere to be found.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have it in modern times. And it sounded like it was only a couple of decades that before that happened.
Yeah, because this is in the 60s, right? So
that it was found, yeah. Yeah. So this guy, Ron Calais, though, he actually x-rayed it and did some other analysis on it because they didn't further cut it open. They just kept it in half and didn't really try to pry out what was in there. And he saw other parts, including like a small spring. And again, the x-rays are in the images. You can see those in some of the articles we have. So this got latched onto as ancient technology. I didn't really see the word aliens thrown around too much, which is surprising. I kind of thought I would see some sort of alien mention.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of tangentially mentioned in some of the other articles that were about like alien things, and that the Koso artifact is mentioned. But what most people seem to think is that this is evidence of advanced technology 500,000 years ago that has since died out.
Right.
Yeah. And it has to be 500,000 years because that's when geodes formed.
Because that's when geodes formed and it looks like a geode. So therefore it is a geode.
I mean, if you're going to go there, maybe it was somewhere else and then he wrote it out of the landscape and then turned into a geode. But maybe it's 1 million years old.
Right.
Maybe it's 10 million years old. I mean, the sky's the limit here.
Yeah.
So anyway, it was also suggested really early on that this looks like a spark plug.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did people say, yeah, sure, I could see spark plug, but then they immediately jumped to the conclusion that it was a 500,000-year-old spark plug. Evidence of internal combustion engines.
Not it's a spark plug. Therefore, it must be modern. No. It's a 500,000-year-old spark plug. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So not too many people had actually the ability to look at this thing. The discoverers eventually tried to sell it. They were relatively noncommittal about what it was. They were like, oh, it could be relatively modern, but it could be super old and related to like Atlantis or something like that. You know, they even said Atlantis. And there's evidence that they thought they tried to sell people on the older fact because they tried to sell it for $25,000. It doesn't sound like they did. If they did, it was a private sale and it's lost forever.
It is lost, yeah.
Yeah, but it sounds like that's where they were with this thing. But again, nobody knows where it's at now.
I get it. Make a buck, right?
Well, I mean,
if all these crazy people want to believe that it's a 500,000-year-old spark plug, then okay.
I
mean,
I would have been like, yeah, it's probably from the 20s, but hey, it could be 500,000 years old. I haven't cut it open. You want this for $100,000? Sure, you find out. So I'll definitely do that.
But, you know, word of caution, that's the kind of attitude that brings these hoaxes and forgeries into the public sphere. And then you lose the fact that there is skepticism around it. And then all of a sudden it becomes truth. So
yeah, once the original discoverers and the actual thing itself is pretty much gone, it's just part of lore now and people latch onto it. Yep. So, but when you find literally no other evidence to support anything like this, you got to kind of wonder about this. If there was a society running around with internal combustion engines in the Owens Valley, it's called. If they were there 500,000 years ago, I think we'd see more evidence.
Right? Totally.
Unless the spark plug just fell out of their hovercraft while they were going across the ground, because, you know, why not? Anyway, creationists have taken this, again, as evidence for advanced technology and ancient civilizations. And there's actually an organization called OOO Parts, I think, which stands for, what does it stand for?
You told me, but I can't remember.
Yeah. Oh, it stands for it's OO Parts, Out of Place Artifacts. And and so you put that one together. OO Parts. Yeah, Out of Place Artifacts. Oh, and that is evidence to them. You know, in some ways, people didn't, travel the world and things like that because they wouldn't have time, especially if you're a young Earth creationist, to do that in 6,000 years.
Right.
So, I don't know. There's a lot of really crazy things. The biggest problem with this artifact, aside from the fact that it's not a 500,000-year-old spark plug, is that it's actually not a geode either.
Yeah.
Thought it was a geode.
I know. You got to drop that 500,000-year thing immediately.
Yeah.
Because it's not an actual geode.
No, it's not. And geodes have very precise characteristics to define them as geodes. They have a thin outer shell of dense chalcedonic silica and a layer of quartz crystals on the inside. Everybody's seen the inside of a geode, right? It's all quartz crystals in there. That specifically is a geode. This has literally none of that.
Right.
And in fact, one of the original discoverers, Virginia, said it seemed like it was baked clay. So it just got covered in dirt, baked in the sun for, you know, we'll talk about how long, but baked in the sun, it doesn't take long. It gets super hot out there and very dry.
Yeah.
And if clay is wet enough and it gets out enough, I mean, we've seen bits of clay that almost seem like ceramic pottery. And I mean, pottery usually is fired at a few hundred degrees, but, you know, it doesn't have to be to get that really hard quality to it.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's some of the earliest building materials are just sun-baked clay, you know, because you can form it into whatever shape you want and then just leave it out in the sun to dry and it'll get hard enough that you can mold it and build it with it, you know? So,
yeah. And the fact that it had things encrusted around the edge of it, again, not a huge surprise. Let's say it is a spark plug and somebody drops it and it's a rainy, muddy day or something like that. And it gets kicked around and instantly covered in mud. And then, you know, if it's already covered in mud through some way and then maybe even a decade later through erosion and further rainfall and snowmelt, this clump gets dislodged from wherever it was, rolls around a little bit because things move around in the high, high winds of the desert. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of obstructions to stop it from doing that. It'll pick up things along the way and, you know, just bake into whatever it's going to be. And, you know, maybe other things will get encrusted on later. I think about it like a big, dirty snowball.
Yeah. That's so accurate. I love that description.
Yeah.
And it makes me want to blame my Nevada arch nemesis, site arch nemesis, but I will take on the arch nemesis for sites since they are not real and I am a real person. And that would be cows and grazing.
Yes.
I mean, I literally found an artifact this past season that was in the hoof print of a cow broken into three pieces and still in place where the cow stepped on it. Anyway, cows are destroying and trampling our cultural resources, but that's a topic for a different day. Sure. So I'll get off that soapbox, but can't you just imagine though, like this thing having been dropped into a muddy pit, mm-hmm. like you're saying, and then however long later, cows come along and cows kick up dirt. They do. They're
hoof draggers.
They are, and they wallow in it. It just gets knocked around, and all of a sudden, you've got this clump of clay wrapped around mm-hmm. whatever is inside of it, and it gets kicked around by cows, picking up more things as it rolls around and gets kicked around, and then all of a sudden, you've got a dirty snowball.
Yeah. Well, somebody finally answered the question much later on. Mm-hmm. In fact, not all that long ago. And they took pictures of this, even just the cross section and then the x-rays, to basically a spark plug historian, mm-hmm. Somebody who knows these things. And I got the impression, they didn't really have a lot of detail on this, but I got the impression the person like is a historian at the Champion Spark Plug Corporation.
Okay.
Right? The people that make Champion Spark Plugs. I doubt they're their own company anymore. Maybe they are. They're probably bought by somebody. But anyway, the guy was like listening to the story of this thing and basically laughing and saying, yeah, that's definitely a Champion spark plug. And he's like, and it's probably from the 1920s. He yep. could just tell by looking at it. He's yep. like, this is a thing. Now, other people would probably say, yeah, I mean, if you're going to invent the internal combustion engine, there's not a lot of ways to do that probably. And maybe spark plugs are something that was invented for the internal combustion engine many times over, you know, throughout history. Like if they've got internal combustion engines on another planet, they probably have something akin to a spark plug, because internal combustion means there's explosions happening internally and you have mm-hmm. to time those, and spark plugs are timed. They fire a spark on a, that's what a timing belt is for. The timing belt moves your crankshaft or your camshaft, whichever one, I'm getting those two wrong. Anyway, the shaft inside the engine, which moves your pistons, which mm-hmm. brings in fuel and air. The spark plug goes off, blows up that fuel and air, moves the piston back down and sets the whole cycle off over again. And that happens, you know, 4, 6, 8 times, depending on how many cylinders you have for every cycle.
Mm-hmm.
That's what a spark plug does.
Right.
So if you're going to make that kind of an engine, you're going to need something like that.
Yep.
But the point is, it doesn't have to be shaped like that. We just chose to shape it like that back in whenever we developed these engines. Mm-hmm. And that's how it is. So the thing that irritates me about this isn't really a hoax. This is just something people latched onto.
Yeah. People just didn't know. And
yeah. And yeah. the thing that irritates me about this is there's no way to positively say, I mean, without a doubt that, yeah, there weren't spark plugs, however long you're talking about, mm-hmm. because the landscape destroys things.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way we can say that 200 million years ago, there wasn't a society that is now under the Atlantic, you know, seabed and there has been completely destroyed.
Yeah. You can't prove a null question, right?
Right.
Like when you're trying to prove a no, that's not science, because you can't prove no is the yeah. answer, you know?
All we can do is dramatically reduce the probability that
exactly.
it's right.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so, and that, I think we've done that. So.
And stuff like the COSO artifact, I mean, they're ancient aliens, people, and people who are like those kind of theories, they're always going to latch on to stuff like this. And it doesn't matter how many times you disprove it or how much evidence you show them that it's actually this current modern thing or whatever. They're just not going to believe it.
Yeah.
Because they just won't. They just won't.
All right, well, we are tied at one apiece in a game nobody is playing. Next, we'll go to the lightning round.
The back lightning in a minute. Round!
You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to the final segment of episode 147 of the Archaeology Show. And we are talking about hoaxes, and we're just going to, there were so many of these.
Yeah, we couldn't pick.
Yeah, we just wanted to just jump into a whole bunch of them here in the last segment and just briefly talk about them.
Yeah.
One of the most famous hoaxes of all time is Piltdown Man.
Yeah, we put this in the lightning round because we figure most everybody's heard of it.
Yeah. Found in, I don't know where Piltdown comes from, either the town or region or county or whatever of England,
mm-hmm.
basically, in Britain. Found in 1912, it basically would have changed human evolution as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things had already been found, not some of the big players in human evolution, but like Neanderthals and a few other things. I think mm-hmm. Java Man was found in Indonesia in the late 1800s, early mm-hmm. 1900s. I can't remember. But essentially, nobody's ever come forward for this, by the way. Nobody's ever been found as the culprit, but it's pretty well thought that somebody just wanted England to be on the map as far as
a place for human evolution. Yeah.
The British Empire was already in pretty much decline. I mean, come on. They were losing territories left and right. Somebody was like, England was first and people were here first. So they wanted something.
It's always about saying that the thing that you are part of, the place that you're from, is the first or the best or the most important, right?
Well, like I said, it's always what it's about. It's creating your own narrative.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. So anyway, found in 1912, it's supposedly a 1 million year old hominid fossil skull. And it, like I said, would have changed everything. But it turned out to be a mix of orangutan and modern human bones.
Yep.
And nobody knows who did it.
Yep. When you look at the pictures, you can really see how they are mixed between the two species. And it's pretty clear now. I don't think it was at the time because people didn't understand as well. But
well, I mean, they were pretty smart. And I think they kind of figured it out pretty quickly.
It was pretty quick, I think.
Yeah, it was a hoax.
Yeah, I mean, once it got into the hands of experts, they disproved it pretty quick.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, take a look at some of our links in the show notes as we're going through this, and you can read more about it. But we just want to, again, announce a few of these things.
Mm-hmm. So the next one is the Kensington Runestone. And I believe we mentioned this just briefly in our Viking episode, so we wanted to make sure we brought it in here. But we did kind of talk about it a little bit already. But the basic story is that in 1898, a farmer named Olaf Oman uncovered...
This is the best name ever.
I know, it's so great. Uncovered a stone engraved with runes near the town of Kensington in Minnesota.
I just feel like somebody named Olaf is going to get up to some hijinks. I don't know what that's going to be.
I mean, he does in Frozen, so...
that's what I'm talking about. Like, if your name is Olaf, you're up to some shit.
And warm hugs.
Yeah.
Anyway. So scholars at the time said that it was carved by Vikings in the 14th century. Therefore, Vikings entered America before Columbus and all the other early explorers did. And what would that do? Change the narrative about who entered and settled this land first. Let's not talk about Native Americans. Obviously, white people at this time do not talk about or acknowledge Native Americans. So,
but isn't it funny that all this stuff that supposedly came here, Native Americans couldn't possibly have done it, but it's some sort of artifact from someplace else. Is it funny how the story is never Native Americans went to somewhere else and brought something back?
Oh, no, never. Because then they would be responsible. Yeah. No. The white people did it.
Yeah. Now, I don't think that's likely either. No. Like, they didn't travel to, you know, Denmark.
No. Oh, my God, no.
Pick up some gift shop runestones and bring them back.
No.
Yeah.
So, as we mentioned in our last episode, these runes, they didn't match the ones that were used in the 14th century, and the actual runic code that was carved on there, it was very similar to one that is known to be used by Swedish travelers in the 19th century in the same time that the stone was found. So probably not pre-Columbus. So really all this stuff is stacked against it. And what it really looks like it was is that the people in this area, they just wanted to find a little bit of themselves in who discovered the Americas rather than the Spanish and the Italians and all the others that were getting credit for the discovery, right?
Mm-hmm.
Discovery, put big quotes around the word discovery. So this was just their way of throwing their hat in the mix and changing the narrative so that it was, you know, Norse ancestors who actually discovered. So that was probably the reasoning behind it.
Yeah. Well, even if they did go to Denmark and somebody gifted them this runestone, it's nothing like what Constantine gave to Pope Sylvester the First. Or Pope Sylvester I? How do you say that?
I think it's Sylvester the First.
Even though it's not like a genetic dynasty?
Yeah, because you would say like John Paul II, right?
Yeah, I suppose you would.
Yeah.
So what did he give to the Pope? He's like, here you go. Happy birthday.
Oh, he just gave him like all of Rome.
And all of Rome's things.
All of Rome, the city, the territories, all of it. He just, on this one document, apparently, he just signed it all over to the Pope.
Yep.
So this document goes back centuries. It was copied and recopied over and over and over. The original is lost. There are copies going back to the 8th century. So this is, you know, a millennia in the making. Now, the original reason for why this document was forged is unknown. And the reason we know it's a forgery is because Constantine definitely didn't do that. Like, that's basically it. Because modern scholars have not seen the original. So we can't prove that it's a forgery for that reason. But, like, he definitely didn't do that. It's kind of the reasoning. And nobody believes it now. But in the Middle Ages, it was used by popes to try and, like, keep a handle on the rulers of Europe, keep control of them, say, hey, actually, we own all you guys as per Constantine, you know, 1,000 years ago. So you got to do what we say now.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to try what you can, I guess, to keep control of those wily European rulers.
That's true.
Could have changed history, though, if people actually believed it. And then all of a sudden, Europe is controlled by by the Catholic Church that would have made it a very different place.
Yeah. What did Jesus's wife have to say about that?
So another wonderful document hoax related to religion is the Gospel of Jesus's wife. And now this is a papyrus that's with a statement from Jesus referring to his wife in some places with the name Mary. So obviously right. Jesus was not supposed to have been married, and he definitely wasn't married to Mary Magdalene, but scholars and people who would like to change that narrative have really latched onto this.
I mean, I've seen the Dan Brown movies, so right. I know the full story. See?
Now, this is a relatively new announcement. It came from a researcher at Harvard, a Harvard professor named Karen King in 2012. So this is not that long ago. However, she, you know, like rediscovered this papyrus and then made the announcement. But the provenance is so, so suspect, right? The owners are anonymous, number one. They will not come forward and say who they are. And second of all, they bought it from someone, and his name is in the article that we'll link to. But they got it from a man who had it, who acquired it in East Germany in the 60s. Okay. Now that person has passed away and cannot corroborate this story. But the estate and family members and people who knew the man said that there's actually no way that he owned it because he lived in West Germany, number one. There's no way that in the 1960s Cold War era, he was hopping from West Germany to East Germany to get his hands on this papyrus. Mm. So it just does not. The provenance is really suspect, and there's nobody alive that can prove what the owners say. Second of all, the papyrus is old. It's 1,200 years old, but it's not as old as it should be. The ink might also be old. They're going to do more testing on it. We should see more of that coming out in the coming years. And then the other more damning as evidence is that the owners also had a second papyrus with this one. And it's a section from the Gospel of John. And this section is proven to be a forgery. It is a copy of a well-known published translation from 1924. Okay. And it's Egyptian writing from 1924, and it's written exactly the same way. And then the ink and the handwriting on the two pieces of papyrus are very similar, and it seems likely that they're both fakes. So this combination of all of those things makes it seem very likely that these are fakes. Mm-hmm. More testing to come, though.
All right. Now we're going to go to the Piltdown bird, the Archaeoraptor. Is this a archaeological hoax, or is this a paleontological hoax?
It's paleontological, but I loved it because they called it Piltdown bird, so we had to include it in the list.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Nice.
So in 1999, National Geographic magazine, you know, touted the discovery of a feathered dinosaur fossil named Archaeoraptor Leonin Genesis?
Sure.
Yeah. Doesn't matter because it's a hoax.
Yeah.
So it has the feathered arms of a bird and then the tail of a dinosaur. So they were calling it the missing link between birds and dinosaurs. No. So it's a fake, and it is made of pieces of unrelated fossils that were glued together by a fossil hunting Chinese farmer who's just trying to make a buck, probably just trying to feed his family, if we're being honest here. And he sold his creation to a dealer who then sold it to a U.S. dinosaur museum for $80,000. And I'm like, guys, provenance. Did you where did you know where it came from? Like, especially the U.S. museum guy. I'm like, really? Did you ask the dealer where he got it? And like, what was the story behind it? Or did you just jump at the chance to buy what looked to be the missing link, you know, artifact? That it's just crazy.
And let me tell you about missing links real quick.
Yeah.
People have been looking for missing links all the time between certain things.
Mm-hmm.
We know that birds are descendants of dinosaurs. The dinosaurs basically turned into birds. They're all chickens now, which I think is a great poetic justice to dinosaurs.
Yeah.
But anyway, missing links for humans, between humans and chimpanzees. So people have tried to, you know, produce fakes or look for, you know, some sort of weird human chimpanzee hybrid. But you're not going to, a missing link is not going to look like some Frankenstein's monster where, you know, you have this jumble of parts together. Evolution takes millions of years.
Yeah.
So things are going to, they're going to morph so slowly that you might not even see it. And that's why you've got lumpers and splitters in paleoanthropology, that when they find a new artifact that looks hominid or homo on our line, they really have to look at this thing and say, okay, are there truly any characteristics here that just aren't possible with what we know of other things, therefore mm-hmm. new species. But they really have to look in most cases.
Yeah.
You know, so if you find something that's only 100,000 years or 1 million years off from something else, it's going to be very similar. If it's 3 million years off, it's probably going to be different.
Yeah.
If it's 7 million years off, it's going to be probably a lot different.
Yeah.
But still not that much. A skull's a skull.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's just, you just have to think of it like, it's not a linear trajectory, right? Like there's not like bloop, 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 bloop.
Yeah, there's false starts and there's evolutionary things that didn't take.
Yeah.
Just
because you have point A and point C doesn't mean that you found point B in the middle. Like there could be a lot happening in the middle that you just don't know about because you don't have the evidence for it. So stop looking for missing links, guys. Hoaxers, stop trying to make the missing link because that's like the first... First clue that it's not accurate.
One thing everyone wants to be true is giants.
Oh, totally.
I get my hair cut at the same place in Reno several times a year. Mm-hmm. This one guy that cuts my hair.
Is he into the giant theory?
He always asks me if I've got any new information about the Lovelock Giants.
Oh, really?
Lovelock Cave in Nevada has got a lot of great artifacts in it. A lot of really cool things have been found there. But I don't even really know the full story behind it, but apparently some stuff was found that led people to think giants were there.
Okay.
Giant people. Mm-hmm. Giant people were there. But one of the more famous giants, been around for a long time, is the Cardiff Giant.
Yeah. And this comes from one American man who really wanted to play a joke on super religious people. He was reportedly an atheist and he was just tired of fighting with Bible literalists. Literally, he got into an argument with a reverend over whether or not giants existed and other like super literal things mm-hmm. from the Bible. He had this giant carved in 1868 out of gypsum and it was transported over to Cardiff and buried on his friend's farm. Okay, so that's the backstory. That's the setup. That's where this giant comes from. That's the hoax. Well, in 1869, the buddy, a year after they buried it, so they gave it some time, so I guess it could look more legit.
Guy's clearly in on it.
He's in on it.
Yeah.
He has a well dug on his farm, and the well diggers come across this giant, a 10-foot tall, petrified man, right? So they started charging admission to come and see the petrified giant, and they were trying to make a buck, and they were also like poking fun at people that truly believe that there are giants because the Bible says something about giants, right? But, you know, experts are going to get in on this eventually. And just a year later, like there was an expert who took a look at it was like, that's mm-hmm. not even a real person. It's it's gypsum. So this is a hoax. Bye.
Nice.
But yeah, joke's on you, creationists, I guess, was his goal.
Yeah. And this last one is basically the discovery of the people who were making internal combustion engines in North America.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. So we've come full circle here with proof.
Yes.
With the Calaveras skull.
Yeah. We're in California again. And honestly, this might be my absolute favorite hoax. And I'll give you the reasons why. So first of all, the basic story is that in 1866, miners in Calaveras, California County unearthed a human skull buried more than 100 feet deep in a mine underneath volcanic deposits.
Yeah.
So through a series of events, the skull lands in the hands of Josiah Whitney. This would be the namesake of Mount Whitney, which is the tallest peak in the United States, the continental United States, I believe. Yeah, in California. And he was a Harvard professor and also the California state geologist at the time. So he was, you know, a guy with some clout behind him. He announced it as placing humans in America in the Pleistocene era, somewhere in the 2 to 5 million years before present time frame. I want to know why a geologist is making this determination and not an archaeologist or a paleoanthropologist, which they didn't really have at the time, but... You know, they had people who were more experts in this kind of stuff than geologists.
Really have archaeologists either, to be honest.
No, I guess not really. So maybe geologists would be the best one.
Yeah.
Either way, that was his determination, is that this thing was 2 to 5 million years ago, from two to 5 million years ago. And he went off with that determination and he like lived his whole life believing that's what that was. Mm-hmm. Right. But there were rumors that the skull had been planted. And the scientific community like pretty quickly rejected it as being actually from the Pleistocene era. And about 30 years later, an actual archaeologist, somebody with credentials, kind of went on a hunt to figure out like what this thing was, where it came from, and why they would say that it was as old as it was. So he went back to the community of people where this skull was originally found to try to talk to them, because he had heard rumors that it was a practical joke or a hoax or whatever. And through some talking to people and hearing a couple confessions and some sleuthing, he determined that the skull was planted there by a man who was known for practical jokes. Yeah. And he was trying to play a practical joke either on the local doctor in town or on Josiah Whitney himself, which one is a little bit unclear. But the skull was planted either way by this guy. And then a different miner uncovered it. He set it up so a different guy would find it, a guy who was not involved in it. But the guy did exactly what he predicted and ran straight to the local doctor, a Dr. Jones, with this skull. Like, look what I found in the bottom of this mine, right? The doctor kind of thought it was a hoax right away and didn't take the bait.
Used his instincts.
I know. He didn't take the bait immediately, but then he kind of like started looking at it and then just was like, okay, sure, this thing is real. And then he's the one who sent it off to Josiah Whitney. And then that's how it kind of became part of the thing. So whether that practical joke was meant to be on the doctor or on Whitney himself is unclear. Apparently some of the people in the area might have had some, they might have had some dislike of Whitney. I don't know. It's possible. But either way, in 1992, radiocarbon dating proved once and for all that the skull was only about 1,000 years old. Sounds like it was probably stolen from a nearby Native American grave. But, you know, that's people doing things that they shouldn't do 100 years ago.
I wish they'd put a spark plug in its eye socket. We'd really know. So that was 1866. By any chance, 3 years later, was that guy in Cardiff?
I know, right? A lot of playing. You know, I think it was just easier to play with people's brains and time and archaeology because it just wasn't well established yet. So people could try to mold the narrative to what they wanted it to be.
Yeah.
Or just play a practical joke. I do love that this one was just a practical joke, but it kind of snowballed out of their control.
Absolutely.
Yep.
All right. Well, that's it for this show. It was probably going to be a little shorter, but it's actually longer. So there you go.
I think you say that in every show.
I think I do. I'm just going to copy that as a file just into every show.
Sorry. I have lots to say. You can't shut me up.
I know. All right. Well, thanks for listening and go check out the show notes and do your own research when you see stuff like this and make your own determination. What do you think?
Always. Always make your own determination.
All right. Back next week. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.